Take me where the promises are real.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Okay, so tonight's speaker is a lady that I've been seeing in the rooms for a while. And I thought that she would be a great speaker, and her name is Barbie.
Hey, my name is Laura. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 30th of 2014. I have a home group, The Tradition, and I have a sponsor, and I am available to sponsor women, which is absolutely a very bright spot in my life today. I geek out on AA a lot, a whole lot, because it's the only thing that has ever done anything to relieve me of my alcoholism, to relieve me of the bondage of self, which at the end of the day, it's me that's the problem. And, you know, by working with other women and coming here and sharing my story and just being part of Alcoholics Anonymous and the service, I get free from the only thing I've ever needed freedom from, and that's myself. So I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory University Hospital, one of the last babies born there, and to a mom and a dad, and we lived in Candler Park, and I don't remember a lot about my childhood, but I do remember that I liked to party at an early age. And when I was 4 years old, I grabbed up my best friend Tia, and I said, let's go around the neighborhood and plan a picnic. And, I have three children. I teach children. Like, that's not normal behavior for a four-year-old. You know, you don't just, like, take off in the neighborhood and start, you know, issuing, like, dishes that they're supposed to bring and, you know, telling the time and the place. And then, you know, my dad came and got me, and, you know, I got punished for it. And I just didn't understand what the problem was, you know. And that was kind of a theme in my life for a long time. Like, what's the big deal, you know? Like, I wasn't hurting anybody. You know, I never really had the right perspective on my behavior and the choices I made until I got into AA and really got busy doing some work. And there is one thing that really stands out from my childhood, and I hear it a lot in meetings, and I always nod my head, and that is just how different I felt, you know, from all the other kids. You know, I mean, first grade, I remember going and just thinking, you know, I don't know how to play. I don't know how to laugh and have fun and be innocent and let go and you know, use my imagination. Everything was very serious, and I always wanted to play inappropriate games, and, you know, I just didn't get the instruction book, you know. I always wanted to, you know, be out of right here, right now, and just, you know, in some other fantasy world. My parents got divorced when I was 8 years old. My sister was just a newborn, and definitely caught my first resentment with her, because all of a sudden she was going to take my stuff and my things and my attention, and it's all about me. And the last day of second grade, my mom picked me up from the bus stop, and we moved to Macon. And At that point, I had to grow up pretty quickly because my mom had this newborn baby in me, and she had untreated alcoholism. And I grew up in a house with alcoholism, with all of the insanity and chaos and abuse and you know, neglect and fear and all of that that comes along with it. And I hung my alcoholism on that for a really long time. You know, if you had the mom that I had, if you had the home life that I had, if you lived where I lived and had to do and endure and see what I see, then, you know, you would understand why I do this, you know. And I swore to God at a very early age that I was not going to end up an alcoholic like my mom. You know, and here I stand. God, that gives me chills. And here I stand. And so we moved to Macon, and my mom's drinking really picked up, and my dad remarried, and he started a new family, so, you know, I'm the victim there as well, and I always wanted to fit in and always wanted to be a part of, and the girls in my middle school were going to drink one night, and older sister, parents out of town, classic scenario. They hand me the bottle of Bacardi 151. This is the first time I ever had a drink, y'all, and I drank into a blackout. Mm-hmm. Like, from the jump, I drank alcoholically. I do not have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know, when I put alcohol into my body, I don't react like a normal person. You know, my sister is not one of us, and she will stop, and she'll say, I'm good. You know, I'm starting to feel it. I don't want to overdo it. You know, things that I don't understand at all when someone is drinking, you know. I mean, if you're starting to feel it, that's the whole point. You know, and she starts to feel like she's losing control when she has a couple of drinks. I feel like I'm starting to get control. I'm going to figure it out. It's all going to be okay. You know, these people are my friends. I'm right where I need to be, doing exactly what I need to be doing. And I like to drink hard, and I like to drink fast, and I was shooting that Bacardi, and next thing I know, I'm coming in and out of a blackout, and I'm sick, and the older sister takes me home because she doesn't want to deal with my drunk ass, which I don't blame her. And it was really the first time that I really think my mom and I, like, really bonded on an emotional level. She was very sensitive to how sick I was, and she really took care of me and loved on me. And I was like, you know what? I just didn't do that right. I didn't drink that alcohol correctly. Let me try again. So I tried again because I'm not a quitter. And the same thing happened. You know, drank into a blackout, sick, you know, just all of the insanity that comes along with it. And I was just like, at that point, I still had a choice. You know, I still had a choice in drink, and I could put it down and I could walk away. But I also like to use people, you know, to fill the void. And I quickly got into a relationship in high school, and he became my higher power. He dictated when I was okay and when I wasn't. Absolutely filled the voids, you know, that you know, were so vacant inside of me. You know, he filled those things up, filled those places up. And when I was a junior in high school, he left for the Marines, and I was offered some really hard stuff in chemistry class one day. And I liked it a lot. And I didn't black out, and you couldn't smell it on my breath. And, you know, I didn't come in and out of blackouts, and I could function somewhat, you know, on that. And I proceeded to do that every day for the next couple of years. You know, graduated from high school on it, moved to Atlanta on it. It just took over my life. I burned that relationship with the Marine to the ground, partially because I got pregnant in a blackout in college, and he was like, okay, you're getting married. I'm done with you. Getting married to someone else. Because I kind of have a hard time with relationships and being honest and true and genuine and a person of integrity. So I moved to Atlanta to go to Georgia State because Macon was the problem. You know, I had an idea that, you know, if I could just get out of Macon, if I could just get away from that stuff and these people and my mom, and, you know, life would be different. I know what I need to be okay. And so I moved to Atlanta, and quickly things were not okay. You know, I was still very uncomfortable, still very, you know, very much, you know, not in a position to do life, you know, as a college student, and basically, you know, lost the Hope Scholarship, lost all of the, you know, my resources. My dad was like, you're going to have to move out, because the deal was you maintain a B, you stay in my house, you don't, you leave. I said, give me one more chance, and I completely alcoholically swung the other way and started doing school like it was, like my life depended on it. Like, I was obsessed. I was obsessed with it. I studied all the time, you know. I would drink and do other things on the weekends, you know, or at night before I went to bed. I was a phone caller. How many, raise your hand if you like, be on the phone after you've been drinking. Woo! That just came to me. Yes, I would be on the phone 2 o'clock in the morning, calling. Yeah. So I did that, you know, and I was like, if I can just make a 4.0, then I'll be okay. You know, it was like, if I can just get to Atlanta, I'll be okay. If I can just get into college, I'll be okay. If I can just make this 4.0, I'll be okay. And I got the 4.0, and I wasn't okay. And I thought, okay, well, now I'm so full of ideas. I'm so full of ideas until I get to Alcoholics Anonymous of what I need to do to manage my life. And so I told my dad, I said, I need to move out. That's the problem. The problem is I live here with you, and I'm not having a college experience, and I need to move out. And he was like, you're an idiot. Like, you're living here free. Get your degree, and then get a job, and then you can move out. And I said, well, thanks for sharing, but no, I'm going to do it my way, how I want to do it. And so I took out a student loan, and I incurred all this debt that I'm still trying to pay off. So my dad was absolutely 100% right. So I move into the dorms, and immediately, like the day I get there, I'm like, oh my God, I have made a huge mistake. Like, I just want to go home. Like, this sucks. Nobody's making food, you know. I gotta, like, there's no laundry here, and these people and this stuff, and I didn't like it, and I didn't want to be there. And I met my first hostage. Took my first hostage, who would later become my husband and the father of my children, in the same manner. But yeah, I met Austin, and he let me drink the way I wanted. He liked my crazy. At that point, I wasn't too far gone, and he was, you know, he was that security blanket to me, and you know, alcoholically, I latched onto him and just sucked the life out of him. And, you know, and that's what I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just a taker. You know, what's in it for me? What you got for me? No regard for anyone else. You know, no thought of what I can bring to this relationship. It was just take, take, take. And he eventually moved out of the dorms. I followed him in good hostage taker style and moved right across the hall from him. And we were broken up, but we were still sleeping together. And I was drinking every night, and I was drinking into blackouts. And I love you. No, I don't. Leave me alone. Come here. I want you. No, I don't. Yeah, y'all know what I'm saying. And, you know, and just that insane behavior just all the time. And he finally was like, Laura, stop. Something is wrong with you. You've got to leave me alone. I'm moving. Do not come to my house. And I was like, but I love you. Don't you see that? Like, this is real. This is real. And he was just like, yeah, stay away from me. And I was so hurt. I was so devastated. How could he say those things? And couple of months go by, like 8 weeks go by, and start to feel sick, and you know, when I go to his house, I'm like, I think I'm pregnant. I'm like, I know you told me not to come over here, but I kind of have something we need to talk about. And I was like, I think I'm pregnant, and sure enough, I was. And I said, what are we going to do? And he was like, well, let's get married. And I was like, well, okay. And don't mind if I do. Because yeah. I'm really not digging where I'm living now. And I really don't want to go back to my dad's and with my tail between my legs. And, you know, you got it going on. Like, you know, you've got your stuff together. So maybe you can just take care of me. Because that's what I do. You know, I look for someone who's going to take care of me. And so I thought, okay, this is it. Like, I'm going to have this baby and I'm going to get married and I'm going to be okay. Like, finally, this is going to be the thing. Well, as you can imagine, I get married, I have the baby, and I'm not okay. And I'm worse than I'm worse off than I've ever been. And I was a teacher. He married a college graduate. I eventually graduated from college and got my teaching degree, and I taught for a couple of years, and then I decided that was too much, because that's kind of a theme in my life too, is it's just all too much. I used to sit on my back porch and smoke cigarettes. So it's all too much. This is all too much. And so I quit my job, and I refused to contribute financially to the family because I need to stay home and take care of the babies. That's where I need to be. That was my best thinking. And he's like, Laura, you gotta work. Like, we need money. And I was like, no, you can figure it out. You can figure it out, you know, because I was so selfish and self-centered to the core. And, you know, and I'm continuing to drink into blackouts, and, you know, and he's cleaning up the mess. And, you know, I can't tell you, like, how many mornings I was passed out on the toilet, you know, and he's like, laying on the bathroom, you know, in the bathroom with me with, like, his head in my lap, and, like, I would slip off the toilet and, you know, try to, you know, act like I was starting to sober up and I was going to be okay, and then I'd go to lay in the bed and, like, do, like, a run and dive at the bed and bounce off the side and hit the floor, and, you know, this is his lovely bride and the mother of his children, you know, I mean, it was pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization at this point. And, so I get pregnant again, and we have another baby, and I'm still, you know, still refusing to work, still refusing to give to this relationship, still just taking and taking and taking all I can, and I get pregnant with the third baby, and after that baby's born, I wake up one morning and I can't walk, and I would joke around with Austin and say, oh my God, I need a hip replacement, my hip hurts so bad. Well, sure enough, I wake up this one morning, I can't walk, I go to the doctor, and he's like, you need a hip replacement. Here's some pills, take these, they'll help with the pain. And I remember taking that and going, oh my God, this is it. This is what I was seeking in that 4-0 and in that relationship and in that baby and in that, you know, and in that move and in that relationship. Like, I will do this every day for the rest of my life, you know, and very alcoholically. And I respect singleness of purpose, absolutely. But, you know, this is part of my story. And, you know, I don't know who it's going to help, but, and so I take off down that road, and, you know, it was basically, I could keep a week's supply in my purse. You couldn't smell it on my breath. I didn't black out, but it absolutely filled that void inside of me that I had been so desperately trying to fill my whole life with all this other stuff in the human realm. And so I proceed to, my disease just began to progress at a really high rate of speed, and I just slowly but surely just backed more and more out of life, more and more onto the couch. And when I first entered treatment in 2011, I was the thing on the couch. Like, I was not helping raise my children. I was not contributing financially to our family. You know, I wasn't showing up in my marriage. I wasn't showing up in my friendships. I wasn't showing up in my family. At this point, Austin's parents are having to pay our mortgage. You know, they're having to come over and take care of the kids. He's having to work full time, take care of the kids. And I'm like, what's the big deal? I'm not hurting anybody. You know, what's the big deal? Like, this is what y'all are supposed to do. You know, disease of perception, you know, how wrong I was. And, you know, thank God through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to live like that today. You know, I have a relationship with my children. Oh, thank you. I have a relationship with my children. I'm not the thing on the couch, you know. I have a big couch now that I bought and I paid for. We can all fit on it, right, Davide? And David knows. He comes over. And we all, my kids, all three of them, they're 21, 19, and 14 now, and they want to be with their mama. You know, they love Alcoholics Anonymous. They're not real sure what we're doing here, but they have but they have never once gotten in my way when I need to come to a meeting. You know, they have never once said, no, Mama, don't go meet with that sponsee. They're like, oh, you got a new sponsee? That's great. You know, thank God. You know, my daughter will be like, Mama, go to the meeting. You're getting on my nerves. Go, 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 you know, because this is my treatment for what ails me today. So, you know, at this point, I am, like I said, I'm not showing up in my life at all. I'm just like, I heard a speaker say, just like heart and lungs working, you know, I'm just dead inside. I'm just black. I'm just a shell of a human. And I had been up all night and heard the birds. Y'all know those birds. I hate those birds. I love the birds today. But back then, I hated those birds. And the birds were chirping. And I crawled in bed next to my husband. And I said, I'm sick. I can't take care of the kids. And he wasn't surprised. You know, he knew what to do. And I passed out. And I woke up at like 1 o'clock that afternoon. And the silence in my home was just deafening. It was so quiet. There was nothing moving, nothing stirring, no activity, no life, you know, and this is what I had created for myself. And I remember walking down the stairs and seeing my little kids' shoes and seeing their artwork and knowing that they were going to be getting off the school bus soon and wanting so badly to be able to go out there and show up as a mom, because my dream my whole life has been just to be a good mom, you know. And I couldn't do it. And I couldn't do it. And I called my husband and I said, I need help. And he started crying and he said, thank God you finally see. He said, I'm on my way. And he came home and I was hysterical. I could not stop crying. The nurse on the phone, we called the nurse line and she was like, ma'am, legally, I cannot get off the phone with you until you calm down. I didn't think it was that bad, but apparently it was. And so I checked into Ridgeview and started to detox at Ridgeview. And that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I don't remember anything that was said at my first meeting, but I absolutely remember the women that were there chairing that meeting, you know, and they had showered and they had makeup on and they had on cute clothes and they were smiling and they looked normal, you know, like everything I wanted to be able to do, they were up there doing it, you know, and they said that they had felt like I'd felt and they had experienced what I had experienced and that I could have it too. And I, you know, I didn't really believe them 100%, but that was kind of the first little spark of hope I started having. But I did not think I was an alcoholic. I mean, I knew I absolutely had a problem with drugs, but with alcohol, like, you know, I didn't think I had that problem. And that's one of the cunning features of this disease is that it wants me to think I'm different from you. You know, it wants to keep me separate. You know, I was not a morning drinker. I was not a daily drinker. I was, you know, I never got a DUI, but I absolutely have the disease of alcoholism. I do not react like a normal person when I put that in my body, right? Normal people don't drink into a blackout. Drugs are not always on the table 100% of the time, you know, and you know, the phenomenon of craving does not kick up where it's more, 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 give me more, give me more. And in me, that shows up as going from having that first drink until I am in a blackout within a matter of minutes. You know, I just, the allergy is strong. It is very strong. The abnormal reaction and the obsession, they come on fast and they come on strong. And it took me a while, you know, it took me a while for some, you know, a moment of clarity where I'm like, oh, okay, well, there's not one class of what an alcoholic looks like, you know. I mean, look over your life, look over your drinking career, like, it's very alcoholic, you know. And it wasn't until I came into Fifth Tradition and I got a confident sponsor and I said, I'm not sure if I'm an alcoholic. And she said, well, Laura, what happens when you drink? And I told her, and she said, that's not normal. That's not normal. And I was like, oh, thank God. You know, like, thank God. I could finally see it. And that's when, you know, it started to break through, and I started to, you know, to open up to this program and to what, you know, to what's on offer here. So when I got out of Ridgeview, did not stay sober. We ended up losing the house. We ended up having to file for bankruptcy. We ended up moving across town, which was such a blessing, into a rental house. And I couldn't stay sober. I kept going back and couldn't get it. And, you know, my disease would say things like, well, you know, you've been sober this long. You could absolutely drink like a normal person now. And believing that insanity after what you've heard about my life, you know, like I believed that. I thought that was true. And so I would do it again and I would end up in the same place. And you know, and thank God for that last relapse. It just finally gave me the willingness to do what I needed to do to ask for help, because I was out of options. I was finally out of options. AA was the last house on the street. I had a woman's number in my phone for over a year, and I called her up, and I said, what do I do? I want you to sponsor me. I want to be sober. And she said, start calling me every day. And I just remember my shoulders dropped, and I was like, oh, thank you, God. Somebody knows what I need to be doing, because I don't know anymore. I surrender. I don't know what to do. And, you know, and slowly but surely, you know, she started, you know, meeting with me once a week. We started going through the big book. You know, she told me to get a home group. She told me to get a service commitment. She gave me women to call. And she told me to start praying. And, you know, and I started, you know, doing those things. I mean, not that next day, but, you know, over time, you know, I started to incorporate these things into my life. And needless to say, things were not good with my husband at the time. And I remember, you know, calling my sponsor up a few weeks after we got started working together. And she said, we're not going to talk about him until we treat your alcoholism. Set him aside and let's get through the steps. And then we'll see where you are in that relationship. And I was like, okay, deal. That sounds like a great idea, because I'm exhausted from trying to manage this relationship. You know, because if he would just act right, I would be okay. If he would just get his stuff together, I'll be fine. You know, when Lord knows he had grabbed onto the bumper, you know, and I had hit the gas and just drug him all through my disease. Well, a couple months later, he comes to me and says he wants a divorce. And I said, I assumed it was my alcoholism. I wasn't surprised. I was scared. We had been married for almost 16 years, and he had, you know, he had been my God. He had been my everything, my paycheck, you know, my the mother to my children, the father to my children, the decision maker, you know, the stable, consistent piece of my life that I could count on. And those words, I was terrified of hearing them for years. And when he came to me and he said that, he said, I still love you. You're still my best friend, but my feelings have changed. And apparently that's what a gay man says when he wants to get divorced. I forgot to tell y'all, like, when I first met him, I thought, you know, maybe he's not going to be into me. Like, maybe he's going to be into guys. And he wasn't. He was into me. And I was like, okay, so, you know, we're rocking and rolling. But I called my sponsor before I knew that he had a boyfriend, which comes later. But when he asked for that divorce, you know, I called my sponsor. And she said, Laura, and this is in all seriousness, she said, Laura, it is time to let him go. It's time to let him go. And I heard that. I heard that in my heart. I felt that. And at that moment, like, I let go. I let go of the relationship. I let go of the tight, tight grip I had around his waist. You know, I let go of these old ideas of I need him to be okay. And somehow I just started to get free. And in that, he was able to get free. So he and I talk. We talk with, you know, I talk with my sponsor. We get a plan of what we're going to do. He moves out in January. We're divorced by April. And during all this time, y'all, I'm working the steps. I'm doing a fourth step. I'm doing a written inventory. You know, meeting with my sponsor. I'm doing a fifth step. You know, I'm getting to see a lot of truth about who and what I am. You know, and I'm going from being a victim, which I've been in my life for so long, to being a survivor. You know, I'm having these shifts in perspective, like sometimes big shifts, you know, and sometimes just little shifts of like how I show up in relationships, you know, and what a taker I am and how much harm I've caused these people and how much hurt, you know, and I'm starting to do 8 and 9, you know, I'm starting to call these people and make dates to sit down across the table from them and look them in the eye and tell them how wrong I was. You know, and that I can't imagine what it must have been like to be your daughter. For me to be your daughter. You know, I can't imagine what it must have been like to be married to me. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be my little sister growing up in that house with all that chaos of two alcoholic women. You know, I mean, just, I cannot imagine what it felt like. And, you know, and I started making amends and then you know, my daughter found a text in her dad's phone to his boyfriend, and she sat on that for 2 weeks because she didn't want to tell me. She didn't want to hurt me. And honestly, y'all, I could have cared less. I was so relieved. I was like, there's nothing I could have done to save that relationship. And through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just so glad that he could finally live in his truth and that he could finally be free, you know, and that I had the opportunity to show up as a loving, supportive ex-wife and as a mother, you know, and give him the freedom to be who he was. And because of this program, I knew how to make a phone call to him and say, hey, can we meet for coffee? And we met for coffee and we sat down and I said, you know, I love you and I don't care about a lot of things and choices that you make, and I know you have a boyfriend. And his mouth about hit the table and he about flipped out and he was like, oh my God. I was like, and I don't care. I'm happy for you. I'm happy you can live in your truth. What can I do to support you? That's not me. That's not me. That's a relationship with a power greater than myself that helped me set myself aside and go in there and look this man in the eye and say, what can I do for you now? I'm done taking from you. I'm done expecting you to be someone you're not. You're off the hook. Like, how selfish of me to ever expect someone to be God? You know, like, I hope I never show up like that in another relationship. Hope I never show up like that. And we talked and, you know, and I got to meet his partner and he looks just like me. It's the funniest thing. I'm like, you so have a type, dude. You so have a type. And, you know, brown eyes, dark hair, big smile, short. Yeah, I'm like, it's real cute. But, like, we have a very very amicable relationship today. We spend holidays together. We spend my kids' birthdays together. You know, it's just, it's a beautiful thing. You know, my family supports them. You know, my extended family, you know, has embraced them. And my kids have gotten to see, you know, what it's like to love unconditionally, which is not something I could have ever done before I got here. You know, all they got to know was a selfish, self-centered, you know, thing on the couch. That was their example. And a couple of months after that was found out, I had to have a second hip replacement. And I was able to walk through that and stay sober. Women brought meetings to my house and took me to meetings and called me daily to check on me and shared their experience of how they made it through. And I went and I got a teaching job. I went back to teaching, and I'm going into my 10th year of being an educator in DeKalb County. The government says I could educate your children today. So that is a gift of this program, because there were many, many years when at one point I did have a little job working 10 hours a week, and I managed to get put on probation working 10 hours a week because of my attitude. You know, in my last observation at work, I got a 4 in professionalism, which is, by the way, the highest you can get. So tell me there's no God, right? Tell me there's no higher power at work in me, because I don't show up like that. That is not the girl that came in here. That's not the girl who goes to work, you know, without a lot of work on my part to get there. So I go back to work. I start, one of my amends to my ex-husband is that I no longer ask him for money. And, you know, at first, it took a while to kind of get there. You know, like, I needed some repairs on my car, and my sponsor was like, okay, you can ask him, but you're going to pay it back. And so I started to, you know, I asked him to borrow the money. I got my car fixed, and then I started paying him back. I started being a person of integrity. You know, I started being a person that could keep my word, and, you know, and I never was that before. So go back to work, and I get a phone call during open house that first week of school, and they have found my mom, and she has dropped dead in her driveway going to her car to get her bottle. She died of alcoholism. And I called my ex-husband, right? Because he's still my friend. He's still my friend. And I said, can you help me? And he said, yeah. I said, can you go down to Macon with me tomorrow? We got to identify the body. We got to get her stuff. And I need you. And he absolutely showed up. And he held my hand. And he wiped my tears. And you guys reached out. And you texted me. And you called me. And you brought me food. And you showed me how to show up at my mom's funeral. I was the only person that stood up and said anything. But I learned that by getting up here and saying things. I learned that by praying for God to remove my fear and direct my thinking and set me aside so that I can show up and give some honor and some respect to my mom, a woman that I never, ever, ever wanted to be like, you know. And after doing that work on the steps, I realized, you know, my mom did the best she could with what she had. You know, my mom got up every day and went to work and put a roof over her head and sent us to private school and did all these things. I didn't do that when I was in my active alcoholism. I didn't work. I worked a little job, but I wasn't contributing. You know, I wasn't taking care of my family and my kids, and you know, and it was right with my mom when she passed away. You know, I'd been able to sit down across the table from her and tell her how wrong I was for all the things that I had done, and what can I do to make it right? And she looked at me and she said, "Laura, you're perfect." The words I had longed to hear my entire life, and you know what? Nothing changed. Nothing changed. I didn't feel any different. I didn't grow 6 feet tall. You know, I didn't get I was already full. You know, I was already full. And those words from my mom were never intended to fill me up. You know, I didn't need that or want that from her any longer. It's freedom. You know, that's what we have on offer here is freedom. You know, my sponsor tells me, let's just lay off the relationships for a while. You know, fall in love with AA, get with your women, get busy. One of my assignments was on Friday, the Friday nights that I didn't have my kids, she wanted me to have plans with women in the rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous and keep those commitments. Like, don't flake on Friday when you're tired after teaching all week. Show up. And that was such a blessing, because now I have women that have shown up for me. Continually, you know, I have the best relationships in my life today with women that I never had. I never had relationships with women before I got here. Not genuine, loving, caring, honest relationships. Such a gift of this program. My daughter, my middle daughter, got very sick psychologically and had to go into a residential treatment facility. She was suicidal. She was impeached for 6 times in 1 year. And, you know, you guys showed me how to walk through that and how to show up for my daughter. And we were sitting in therapy one day, and she said, Mom, I mean, it was killing her to say these words to me. This is the child that found the text from my ex-husband and didn't want to tell me because she didn't want to hurt me. And she said, Mom, it's just so unfair. Why does my sister get the sober mom and I got the junkie? Why? It's not fair, Mom. Why were you never there to tuck me in or kiss my boo-boos or keep any promise you ever made to me? And because of this program, I was able to look her in the eye and say, I was so wrong for that, baby. I was so wrong for that. And I'm going to try really, really, really hard to never, ever hurt you like that ever again. And today, you know, she and I have a great relationship. You know, we argue about who loves who the most. And, you know, it's like, she's like, Mom, I love you the most. I'm like, there's no way. There's no way. You know, and she came over Sunday and she was like, I just want to eat and snuggle. You know, and she's 19 and she's still my baby. And, I've gone through a lot of work and a lot of therapy and a lot of, you know, in addition to Alcoholics Anonymous. To get into the relationship that I have with her today, because I didn't come here with any tools on how to be a mama. I didn't come here with any tools on love and tolerance and patience and you know, walking away I didn't come here with any of that. But you guys laid that stuff out at my feet. You know, like, this is how you do it. You know, this is how you do it. And I would pick them up and I would try them out and they would work and I would try it again. And, you know, little by little, I mean, God had to completely destroy my relationship with her. He had to completely break it down, you know, smash it so that he could rebuild the relationship that we have today. You know, and today she trusts me. Today she wants to be with me. Today she can be honest with me and say, not right now, Mom. Not right now. Because I can grab a hold of her like she's a cat, you know, and she's like, ah, put me down. I'm like, love me, kitty. So I've had to learn to just, you know, let her come to me and it's very beneficial. It works if you're parents and you have that kind of kid. I didn't date for a while, and I didn't, you know, I just tried to work on my relationships with women, and I, you know, my relationships with my kids, and I started sponsoring, and really, you know, got on fire with that, and still am, and I sponsor a gaggle of women, which is what somebody in my home group says, which I love. I had met this guy at Clarkston about 9 years ago, and we were on different paths, and our paths crossed a couple of times, I had the biggest crush on him, oh my God, and he just wasn't there yet, like, he just wanted to be friends, and I was like, okay, well, that's cool, but, you know, I have to live in my truth today, because people who don't live in their truth get very sick, and I've learned that in these rooms, and I didn't want to be friends, I want to be more than friends. And so I was like, you know, we can't hang out anymore. I'm not friends with guys. I'm just not. That's just me. And so he was like, all right, I'll see you around the rooms or whatever. And I was like, okay. And it was hard, and I had to walk away from that. Well, 6 months later, Christmas Eve, I get a text from him. He's like, hey, can I come over and talk? And the crazy thing is that when I got here, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know what I wanted in a relationship. I did not know who I was. I did not know about intimacy. I didn't know about, you know, setting yourself aside. I didn't know about, it's not about what I get, it's about what I get. I didn't know any of that stuff. And so I had to bump my head along the way to figure out what I wanted. And, you know, I did some online dating, and I remember talking to my sponsor and going, you know, I think I know now what I want. I think I want a man in AA that's doing the deal, you know, that's got a sponsor and sponsoring men so that I can do this with him shoulder to shoulder, because AA is my life. It's not what I do in a pinch. It's not what I do on the weekends. It's not what I do when I'm, you know, I don't give it up when I go on vacation. It's what I do. It is my life. And she said, okay, Laura, he's probably out there, but it might take you a while. And I said, okay, well, I'm willing to wait. And so Christmas Eve, I get this text, and it's him, and he's like, hey, can I come over and talk? And, of course, the butterflies come back immediately, and I'm like, yeah, I guess. And he comes over and he grabs a hold of me and he hugs me and he says, I've missed you so much. I can't get you off of my mind. And we're getting married in October. Yep. And I said, you know, okay, well, that's great, but I don't want to get swept up in all of this. You know, I'm willing to take my time and get to know you. And let's take it slow. And we did, you know, and we love going to meetings together. we love, you know, sharing our thoughts and stuff on, you know, our prayers and our meditations, and we really, you know, we really get to do this journey together, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's such a blessing, and it was God's timing. You know, it wasn't mine. It was God's timing. And, you know, we dated for a year and a half, and he loves my children. You know, my children love him. He asked them for my hand in marriage. Is it okay if I marry your mom? You know, because this is your mom, and I don't ever want to take that place of her. And, you know, and he's so kind and thoughtful, and he is a true, you know, he's a true example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do. And so we dated for a year and a half, and just naturally things started to progress, and marriage just seemed like the next logical step. And so here we are. You know, I still have that amicable relationship with my ex-husband. And, you know, I have a job today. I'm able to show up. I have friends. I have sponsees. But most importantly, at the end of the day, you know, I absolutely have a higher power that I love to call God, that keeps me sober. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Laura. That was so awesome. Thank you very much.
First I slip and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are. Something that set me free. And I'd love to a world in harmony. See love as a vision that one day. Take me where the promises are.